Well, I want to talk about hypervelocity stars. These are stars unbound from the galaxy by the central black hole. That makes these stars interesting because their properties are then linked to the nature and environment of the black hole that ejects them. And also, the trajectories of these stars may provide unique tracers of the dark matter potential that they're escaping. The problem observationally with hypervelocity stars is they're extremely rare. Ewan Tremaine made a prediction in 2003 that the Milky Way central black hole ejects an unbound hypervelocity star once every 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5 years. That means of the galaxy's 10 to 11 stars, there's maybe 10 to the 3 or perhaps 10 to the 4 hypervelocity stars out to 100 kiloparsecs. Now, I'm talking about these objects because we found them. We reported the first hypervelocity star in 2005. And since then, we've discovered over a dozen new unbound objects in a targeted survey I want to tell you about. There's some brand new results I have to show you at the end of the talk, but I also think it's important to give some context and background to this, so I'll spend some time on that. My collaborators in this work are Margaret Geller and Scott Kenyon. So I've been using the MMT telescope, as you see here, to measure the radial velocities of stars in the outer halo of the Milky Way. It was this sort of radial velocity survey that we were doing when we found the first hypervelocity star, this object here. We were looking for velocity structure in the outer halo, but what we found was a star moving away from us at 850 kilometers per second. Now that velocity is absurd. There is no star in the Milky Way, certainly not in the halo, that moves with a speed anything like this. There are a few pulsars with proper motions that imply they have velocities up to 1,000 kilometers per second, but pulsars are the remnants of massive stars that have exploded as supernova. And so in the distribution of pulsar velocities is well described by this supernova kick mechanism. This star turns out to be a main sequence star, which means it's about 110 kiloparsecs away, well beyond what you think of being the Milky Way galaxy, perhaps. And at that velocity, it is almost certainly unbound to the Milky Way, even if you think the Milky Way is in a 10 to the 13 solar mass halo. So what is this object? And remarkably, such an object was predicted 20 years ago. In a Nature paper by Jack Hills, he pointed out that a three-body interaction between a pair of stars and a supermassive black hole could eject one of the stars at 1,000 kilometers per second. And he called such an object a hypervelocity star. He followed that up with a paper on sort of the orbits you need to produce hypervelocity stars. And then about a decade later, Ewan Tremaine expanded this argument to include the case of binary black holes ejecting hypervelocity stars and to calculate ejection rates. So this was the state of the field prior to 2005. And I always like to say that, if nothing else, our discovery made Jack Hills happy. He's quoted as saying it's high time someone found it. But I think the important thing about hypervelocity stars is that they're really opening up a whole new window on our galactic center. All right, so to put this in perspective, if here's your schematic of the Milky Way galaxy with a bulge disk, we're talking about the outer halo, right? We're finding hypervelocity stars here, 50 to 100 kiloparsecs out of the Milky Way. The hypervelocity stars we're finding are B-type stars, that is, stars that are more massive, much more luminous than the Sun, and because they burn their fuel rapidly, they have short lifetimes of order 10 to the 8th years. So 1947, Humison's Wiki first reported B-type stars at high galactic latitude, that is, B stars up here. Now, because B stars are born in the disk and they live only a short time, you wouldn't expect to find B stars very far out in the halo. Well, spectroscopic surveys have shown that these objects are mixed. Some turn out to be just evolved low-mass stars, normal halo stars. Some turn out to be main-sequence B stars, so-called runaway B stars. So runaway B stars are explained by binary disruption mechanisms. Most B stars are observed in binaries. And so, for example, if you have a pair of three solar mass stars in a contact binary, they'll orbit each other at about 300 kilometers per second. So if you disrupt that binary, say one of the stars explodes as a supernova, loses enough mass to unbind the system, the stars can move away from each other at perhaps their orbital velocity up to 300 kilometers per second. You can do better with a dynamical mechanism, say you have a binary-binary encounter, in which case you can get up to the escape velocity from the surface of the most massive star in that encounter. Now, these theoretical maximum ejection velocities are virtually impossible to realize in practice because compact binaries suffer from energy loss through tidal dissipation, Roche lobe overflow. You can't have compact binary systems that get to these really extreme velocities very easily, which means that runaway stars are mostly ejected at 10 to 100 kilometers per second. There's some nice papers in the last decade that all kind of agree on that point, which means that runaway stars are in all cases bound objects. To get to an unbound velocity requires you interact with a more massive and compact object. So Andrei just told us about this overwhelming evidence for a 4 million solar mass black hole. You just can't argue with that orbit going, you know, SO2 going around the center of the galaxy. What I want to show you, point out to you here, this is a near-infrared image of the central parsec of the Milky Way. And what I want to point out to you is this paradox of viewpoint, which is you can visually see by eye the increasing fraction of blue stars as you move in towards that J star. And spectroscopy shows that these blue stars are B stars, short-lived stars, orbiting right next to the central black hole. And that's a puzzle. And one class of excellent are dynamical mechanisms, such as a three-body interaction that can capture stars into an orbit near this black hole. Well, it's three-body interaction that captures a star, as Hills proposed. And so in this picture, it's the galactic Sag A star that are, the former companions, the high-velocity stars we see today. And so this is how this ejection process might work for the high-velocity stars, illustrated by a simulation by Ben Bromley. So what you're seeing is a compact binary approaching a massive black hole. The moment that the gravitational tidal force exceeds the binding force binding the pair is broken. And the star that's ejected gains an extreme velocity because the potential energy of that black hole greatly exceeds the binding energy of the pair of stars. So quantitatively, this looks like this. You can work out the impulse velocity of the stars onto the black hole. It has to be at least a few percent of the speed of light, 10 to the 4 kilometers per second. That's two orders of magnitude larger than the internal orbit velocity of a compact binary star. And so by conservation of energy, if one star is captured around the black hole, the other star gains a delta energy given by this. And so its final velocity is the geometric mean of these two velocities. And so this is how a massive black hole can accelerate a star to 1,000 kilometers per second. And simply put, it's an inevitable consequence of having a massive black hole in a very dense stellar environment, just like you see in the galactic center. The existence of even one high-velocity star is, in fact, another piece of evidence that you have to have a massive black hole in the middle of all those stars. All right, so let's talk about the observations. I always like to show the discovery spectrum of the first high-velocity star. The low-resolution spectrum, you're seeing here the sort of near UV. These absorption lines of the Balmer series due to hydrogen absorption, the hydrogen. And the spectrum is that of the B9 star. We know it's a main sequence star now for a few different reasons. It turns out it's a fast rotator, and it's slowly pulsing to be variable. So a main sequence star works out to have a distance of about 110 kiloparsecs, as I said before. And so you might ask yourself, well, is this star part of another galaxy altogether? And the answer is no. Neither its position nor its velocity matches up with anything in the local group. There is no dwarf galaxy in the local group that has a velocity anything close to the high-velocity star. So if this star, that means the star has to come from the Milky Way. And the question then is, how do you eject it with such an extreme velocity? And I've answered that, right? So besides explaining its extreme velocity, the high-velocity star origin is consistent with everything else we know, which is namely that the galactic center is full of B-type stars, very similar to the spectral type of this star. This calcium K line here, which you can roughly see, suggests the star is metal-rich. At least it's certainly inconsistent with it just being a metal-poor halo star. And the travel time of this object from the galactic center works out to be about 160 million years, which is well within the 350 million year lifetime of a three solar mass star. So I think it all fits together, and this object must certainly be a higher velocity star.
You said it was rapidly rotating and an FTD star, but FTD star is always slowly rotating.
Well, it's a rough measurement. The best fit to Uli Haber did this fit to the R spectrum. He claims 190 kilometers per second rotation. That's at the almost at the level which you could actually fit given the resolution of the spectrum. So that's suggestive, I think. But the variability is also, I think, more compelling. There is no horizontal black star that varies with that sort of amplitude.
So the mass and the distance between velocity and the
Yes. So the 850 is a The question is, what is the velocity of the star? So the 850 kilometers per second is heliocentric radial velocity. You correct it to galactic rest frame, assuming that the sun is orbiting at 220, that drops down to about 710 kilometers per second, which is at least, you know, something. Depends on your escape, your potential model for the Milky Way, but it's 2 to 3 times escape velocity of the galaxy at that distance. All right. So I guess what I want to say here, too, is that finding one high-velocity star is kind of exciting. But if we could find more of these objects, that would get much more interesting, because then we could start to say something about the nature of this ejection mechanism. And that's because the properties of these stars link to how they're ejected. So what I've described to you so far is what I'll refer to as the Hills mechanism. That is a single massive black hole disrupting binary stars and ejecting a high-velocity star. There's also this binary black hole mechanism. Now, for the Milky Way, there's strong observational evidence against an equal mass binary black hole in the galactic center. But, you know, that can't rule out the existence of an intermediate mass black hole, say a 1,000 solar mass black hole, say that forms in the center of the Arches cluster, at which dynamical friction arguments tell you it would have to inspiral into the central black hole and inject high velocity stars along the way. So by binary black hole, that's the sort of picture I mean for the high velocity stars. Dynamical friction also tells you that there should be a cluster of stellar mass black hole remnants orbiting inside J star. And O'Leary and Loeb have proposed you can have a three-body interaction with one of those objects to create a high velocity star as well. Well, if these three mechanisms can all produce high velocity stars, the question is what is the dominant source for the case of the Milky Way? And I think in principle we can answer that question with the observations. So first let's consider the velocity distribution of these stars. So there's more in a massive compact binary. So the Hills mechanism predicts the most massive stars will have the highest velocities. There is no velocity dependence or mass dependence on ejection velocity for a binary black hole. And the stellar cluster should actually eject the lowest mass stars to the highest velocities. So that's kind of interesting. Susanna Hart and Madow have modeled this and compared it to observations. And they conclude you need a sample of more like 100 high velocity stars to really discriminate these ejection mechanisms. Well, you don't have just velocity to work with. There's also the spatial distribution of the stars. So binary black holes can preferentially eject the highest velocity ejections from its orbital plane. And so it should produce a ring of high velocity stars around the sky. The Hills mechanism and the stellar cluster can in principle eject a high velocity star in any direction, at least, you know, except perhaps for the source of the stars that fallen onto them. You see a similar effect in the temporal distribution. So as a binary black hole hardens and then merges, you should expect sort of a burst of high velocity stars, in this case a simulation for an eccentric inspiral by year 11. Even the stellar rotation of the stars may be linked to the ejection mechanism. So Brad Hansen pointed out that stars in compact binaries tend to be slower rotators on average because of tidal synchronization effects. And so if high velocity stars are ejected by the Hills mechanism, you'd expect the unbound stars to be preferentially slower rotators on average. Lachman and Baumgart have argued that high velocity stars ejected by a binary black hole might be spun up, if anything, by this encounter. So there's actually some measurements now of a few of the high velocity stars here by Lopez, Morales, and Bananos. But measuring the positions, velocity, or spin of any one or two stars is not real helpful. What you really want is the distribution of their properties. So following our original discovery, two objects in existing surveys were announced to be high velocity stars as well by Hirsch, Edelman, and collaborators. One of them is this 9 solar mass B star, so a very short-lived object that's also very, very near the LMC on the sky. So if that object comes to the LMC, perhaps that's evidence for a black hole in the Large Magellanic Cloud. What I want to tell you about is the results from a survey that we've designed specifically to target higher velocity stars. And to illustrate this, I'm just showing you a color plot of stars in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey photometric catalog. Our observational strategy is driven by a couple things. One is that we have to target, because high velocity stars are rare, we have to target luminous stars, right? We have to survey a large enough volume to be able to find one. Surveys of stars in the solar neighborhood have not found high velocity stars because they're simply too rare. And because there's 10 to 11 stars in the Milky Way, we have to look in a way that avoids the known stellar populations of the Milky Way, such as white dwarfs, or in this case, the evolved horizontal branch stars in the halo. So looking at this color plot, you can actually see there's this interesting faint tail of stars with the colors of late B-type stars, that is sort of 2.5 and 4 solar mass kinds of stars, that you know follow the stellar sequence. And it's this color selection that simply defines our survey. We're selecting stars that have very unusual colors. There's only about one star in every 10 square degrees in the sky between 17th and 20th magnitude that has these types of colors. And this is why the survey works. We're avoiding all the known stellar populations in the Milky Way. So over the last few years, we've obtained radio velocities for about 800 stars over 8,000 square degrees, and we haven't found one or two unbound stars, but about 14 unbound stars in that sample. All right, so here's the results in them. This is the histogram of radio velocities corrected to a galactic rest frame for the 794 stars in the survey. So the thing you can see, let me reiterate, we're selecting stars by color. They can have any velocity. There's no kinematic selection. what we find are 26 stars here above 275 kilometers per second, two stars below minus 275. The escape velocity of the galaxy at 50 kiloparsecs is 300 to 400 kilometers per second, if you believe we're in a 10 to the 12th solar mass halo, which means that these stars out here, even though we're measuring one component of velocity, are very clearly never coming back. So that means we found about 14 unbound stars here. They're all moving away from us. We haven't seen anything moving towards us with that sort of velocity, which is consistent with this picture that these things are being ejected out of our galaxy. Most of the stars in the survey have just a velocity dispersion of 105 kilometers per second, which is normal, which means they're normal halo stars. But there's still something kind of funny about this plot, which is that this little spike here around 300 kilometers per second is significant. Even if you ignore these 14 unbound stars, there's less than a 10 to the minus 5 probability of randomly drawing such asymmetry in the tails of a Gaussian distribution with these observed parameters. So this little excess of stars at 300 kilometers per second seems quite significant. And I think the best explanation for them are, in fact, the high-velocity star mechanism. Now, these stars are probably bound, but you would expect a high black hole ejection would probably eject stars in a range of velocities. So let's talk about that. So what we want to know is what's the velocity distribution of stars we'd expect from being ejected from the central black hole. So in a collaboration with Scott Kenyon and Ben Bromley, we've modeled the Hills disruption of binaries containing 3 and 4 solar mass stars matched to our survey of stars. And then we create sort of Monte Carlo catalogs of ejections and then integrate the orbits out through a galactic potential. And the plots show you the results, where I'm plotting the rate of velocity and the distance out of the galaxy. The bounds of these points are simply reflect the volume of space sampled by our magnitude-limited survey. And the lower bound of this envelope here of the points reflects the finite lifetime of the star. So you can kind of see that only the fastest stars survive to reach the widest distances. You see that there are stars ejected at many thousands of kilometers per second, but those are pretty rare kinds of ejections. Most of the stars are ejected at lower velocities. In fact, some of the stars here below zero are actually found falling back onto the galactic center. So clearly, there's stars ejected at bound and unbound velocities. The problem is that stars that have radial velocities much below this threshold are impossible to identify by radial velocity alone, right? They're just lost among all the other gas stars in the Milky Way. So above this threshold, these models predict you might expect to find equivalent numbers of stars in unbound and bound trajectories. And so in our sample, we're claiming we have 14 unbound stars and then 12 possibly bound high velocity stars. So that's actually a pretty reasonable agreement. So the existence of these bound high velocity stars, I think, is interesting because it tells us about their nature. So any star that's traveling at plus 300 kilometers per second must eventually go out, stop, and fall back onto the galaxy about minus 300 kilometers per second. We don't see that. So that tells us these stars must have main sequence lifetimes less than that turnaround time, which is of order about 1 to 2 giga years. Given the color selection of our survey, the effective temperature of the stars that we're observing, that means they have to be 3 to 4 solar mass main sequence stars. And knowing that means we can estimate some reasonable distances for these objects and really start linking this back to the black hole. So the plot on the left here is the cumulative distribution of stars versus distance out of the galaxy. And I'm plotting here their main sequence star distance with the error bar showing you the physically possible range of distance they could have if they were just involved horizontal branch star. In a few cases, the Shell spectroscopy and follow-up shows that they're, in fact, confirmed main sequence stars. All right. So if the ejection of high-velocity stars is a continuous process, their density should fall off as 1 over r squared. Our survey volume increases as r cubed, which means in the simplest picture, their distribution should be linear in r. And in fact, you can draw a straight line through that, which is really kind of amazing. That line is simply the space density of these objects. And so these observations imply that there's a total of about 100 unbound 3 to 4 solar mass stars out to a distance of about 100 kiloparsecs. Well, that's kind of cool. That means if we simply apply our current selection criteria over the whole sky, we can get to this real statistical sample of high-velocity stars. Right. So here's, on the plot on the right, as I'm showing again, the distance of the stars and their rate of velocity corrected to the galactic rest frame. Well, if you know distance and velocity, you can calculate travel time. And that's indicated here by these dotted lines. These are isochrones, let's say, at 60 million years, 90, and so forth. These dashed lines down here are two different models for escape velocity. So this plot, I think, is pretty obvious, kind of amazing, because it's, in essence, showing you the history of stellar ejections out of the Milky Way, presumably by the central black hole. Now, statistically, this set of travel times is consistent with a continuous process, as you see here as well. which is to say there's no strong evidence that there's been a dwarf galaxy or star cluster that's fallen into the galactic center in the last couple hundred million years, or at least one that's produced a coherent burst of hypervelocity stars. Now that said, you know, you can't really rule out that maybe, you know, these six stars all came out 120 million years ago. I think this is the proposal by Abadi et al. But, you know, for the case of a binary black hole, which would produce a burst of stars, hypervelocity stars, these stars are actually going the wrong sense. So as the binary black hole hardens and then merges, you expect the ejections of stars to get more energetic, which is the opposite sense of these stars. So the most recent ejection is the slowest, and some of the earliest ejections are the fastest. So it's unclear to me whether we can actually say anything significant about this at the moment. But it's not just the velocity distribution that's interesting, but their spatial distribution. So this is a brand new result. It's been refereed now in the FJ letters, but not yet accepted. This is the spatial distribution of high-velocity stars in the sky. So it's a sky map in galactic coordinates with the North Galactic Pole here in the middle. The dots are all the stars in our survey for which we have radial velocities, and the overall distribution is just that of the Sloan photometric catalog. You can see the high-velocity stars in magenta, and for completeness, here's one of these other, this sub-RFO high-velocity star. Now, it's probably striking that these don't look particularly randomly drawn from the survey region, and we can test that. So the simplest test is just to plot, in this case, the cumulative distribution of galactic longitude and galactic latitude for the survey stars and the hypervelocity stars. And the KS test gives a 0.007 likelihood of randomly drawing the hypervelocity stars from the survey star distribution. So it would appear to be sort of significant at, say, the three sigma level. Interestingly, the galactic latitude distribution is more or less consistent with the underlying survey. You can cut this different ways. I calculated the distribution of angular separations of the hypervelocity stars versus the survey stars, and I also did a two-point angular correlation function calculation. In all cases, you get kind of the same result, which is that the anisotropy appears significant at maybe sort of the three sigma level. So I think it's for real. And the question is, well, then, is what is it telling us? I mean, it must be telling us something. And you may disagree with this explanation, but I think the most plausible explanation may be the underlying potential of the Milky Way galaxy. So these stars are ejected from basically zero kill, you know, the very center of the galaxy. And the galactic potential maps their initial velocity to the final velocity that we observe today. And so if that potential isn't spherical, if it's anisotropic, you might expect to find preferred directions on the sky to find the fastest stars. Okay, to talk about this, though, we really need to have an accurate potential model that's good from 0 to 100 kiloparsecs, because the hypervelocity stars are traveling that entire range of distance. So this is the plot of the gravitational acceleration in the galaxy versus distance in the galaxy. This is taken from the Kenyon 2008 paper. And so what you're seeing here is your standard sort of Woodward-Dubinsky self-consistent potential model, the disk halo bulge. It sums up the solid black line. Except it turns out that this potential model underestimates the observed mass in the central 10 to 100 parsec region of the Milky Way by about an order of magnitude. This was pointed out by Stolde et al, who showed that the Arches cluster, for example, is unbound to the galactic center unless you match the potential to the observed mass distribution. And when you do that, you just force the potential to match the observed mass distribution, you get this red line here. And the upshot is the bulge potential is actually an extremely effective high-pass filter. A star has to be traveling at least 800 kilometers per second to get to 1 kiloparsec in this potential model. Well, and that's actually good in the case of this explanation that I'm trying to put forth. That means if there's some anisotropy on this, it's not so hard to imagine keeping the fastest stars at bound velocities in some direction, and in other directions they're much more easily escaped. another way of going about constraining the potential is to use the trajectories of the high-velocity stars. So Oleg Nedden wrote a paper in 2005 pointing out that any deviation of the star's trajectories from the galactic center tells you about how the underlying potential has changed their orbit. So to do this, though, you need to know the full space motion of the high-velocity stars. The expected proper motion on the sky is a few tenths of a milliarcsecond per year, which means you can't really do it from the ground unless you perhaps you have AO. So we have a Hubble Space Telescope proposal program, 32 orbits now, to go after the proper motions of these stars in the sky. So hopefully we'll know the answer, both where they're coming from and perhaps even address the anisotropy of the dark matter potential. So I'm doing well here. I just want to say there's a lot of interesting directions you can go with this. I want to push the discovery survey. There's a lot of follow-up work to be done, prop motions. There's some interesting simulations to do yet, you know, tie the observed properties that we velocity distribution of stars, say, to the orbits of the galactic center. And there's other unusual objects that have come out of the surveys that are kind of cool as well. We found the lowest mass white dwarf last year and some pretty extremely metal poor galaxies as well. So in conclusion, a massive black hole will eject high velocity stars out of a galaxy. This is true for any galaxy. The high velocity stars we can observe are the ones that are coming out of the Milky Way. We found now, we think, something like 14 to 18 high velocity stars. Depends on where you want to make your cut on that. And that's interesting because it's the distribution of the properties that's linked to this history of stellar ejections out of the galactic center. The nature of the black hole ejection, the mass function of stars orbiting, the types of stars orbiting near the black hole, and potentially, you know, measurement of the dark matter potential that they're escaping. So with that, thank you.
Okay, so we have plenty of time for questions. So let's start with Andy, and then we'll go Julio.
So that explanation of potential just seems to violate freshman physics, to my way of thinking. So,
okay,
you know, the velocity difference between, you know, really doesn't depend on the direction of travel, right? I mean, it just depends on the potential.
I guess what we're saying is that the star will experience more or less deceleration as it exits the galaxy in different directions in the sky. If it's an anisotropic, then it's potential. So we calculate a potential model where we think we can make this work. I mean, I'm completely open to other explanations, but it's just one that we thought seemed plausible. So we're assuming a bulge mass of 3.67 times 10 to the 9th solar masses with a minor to major axis ratio of 0.66 and a scale length of about 100 parsecs, which is smaller than your normal bulge, but it matches the mass distribution. So anyway, if you work it out, we think we can make the resulting distribution work. We could be wrong.
So just to reiterate a point that we discussed over this week, if you assume that the halo mass of the Milky Way is about 3 times 10 to the 12, not 10 to the 13, then the scale, and you assume you take a cosmologically motivated mass distribution from, say, cold dark matter simulations, then the escape velocity at about 50 kiloparsecs is more like 650 kilometers per second, not 350. Therefore, it means that most of the stars actually would be bound, mm-hmm. and only one perhaps would be unbound. And that motivated us to look into, you know, other possibilities as to explain, you know, this coincidence in travel times, this coincidence in, you know, this clustering of the stars in the sky. And, you know, one obvious explanation is just a tidal tail of a disrupted dwarf, which actually fits, you know, many of these properties without resorting to the ejection mechanism from the black hole. So I think the jury's still out as to, you know, exactly what it is. I'm not saying that these things don't exist. I'm not saying that black hole doesn't exist. I'm not saying that, you know, hypervelocity are not produced this way. But, you know, we should not, you know, rule out very quickly the possibility that there might be a simpler dynamical explanation for at least some of these stars.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I would agree that tidal disruption is possible, and it's a very interesting proposal because it's testable. The problem I have is that a single disruption event can't explain the entire observed set of high velocity stars. Their travel time span 2 times 10 to the 8th years. You'd have to have multiple events to explain the overall distribution. Okay.
So I just want to make a quick comment relative to that. So one of the exciting things that SEGWAY is doing and SEGWAY 2 is doing and that the Sloan Sky Survey has done serendipitously is to search for these FNG type, you know, old population hypervelocity stars. And actually, we think we do have candidates returning to the galaxy. So we're doing exactly that. Julio is looking, kind of going, Warren's coming down the mass function and we're trying to go up with the Sloan Survey.
So what becomes possible in an era of ELTs? You can obviously probe further down the luminosity function. Have you thought about that?
What we're doing is a fairly straightforward observation. The question is, what can an ELT give you? I think the interesting thing here is you can do follow-up with shell spectroscopy on these stars, really nail what they are, what their distances are, the nature of the objects. I think for
that means seeing fainter stars, just other
modern telescopes, low-resolution spectrograph can measure rate of velocity good to 10 kilometers per second for 21st magnitude star. That's not very hard. So I think that with existing imaging catalogs, we need multiple pass color photometry to do the selection. Existing telescopes are probably enough to find to identify the candidates at least.
So I would like to second Warren's concern about the knowledge of our potential in the inner 10 to 100 parsecs. All the star counts are based on the infrared data from the 80s, and we have this spectacular results now on the inner few parsecs, but we really have not advanced very much on this 10 to 100 parsec range, and there are also very few dynamical measurements. So my plea would be, if you can, please go, map the galaxy in the inner parts, at larger scales, give us better measure of the potential. It is important.
Wouldn't the distribution of the stars and disk influence, for example, the nature of the stars, the young stars being in a disk, influence their ejection direction? And the second question is, do you have any metallicity constraints from the Echelle spectroscopy that would almost certainly rule out the disrupted dwarf hypothesis if they're metal rich?
So the first question is, what about the disk of the B stars observed from the galactic center? Yes, that'll produce, if stars scatter in from that disk, that'll produce preferred directions on the sky for where the ejections will go. My concern is the travel time span, again, 2 × 10⁸ years. I find it, I'd be hard pressed to believe that disk structure persists for over that time period. But to explain this, you need multiple disks, then all with the same orientation, more or less, to come out with a big clump of stars. I mean, this. Oh, I could do that. I've made different versions of the plot. Yeah.
Most of the ones that are close to there actually have a similar travel time. That is the idea of this disrupted dwarf. There is a coincidence in spatial clustering, an angular clustering, as a coincidence in travel time as well.
Yeah.
It is as good as you can expect with 20 stars, but I think it's there.
I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
The second question was
metallicity. So there's four stars with Echelle spectroscopy. One is the one near the LMC because it's bright. That has a half solar iron abundance. Whether you think that means it comes from the LMC or the outer disk, who knows, but it's broadly consistent with probably coming from anywhere. This star here, HVS7, turns out to be a peculiar B-type star. It has these phenomenally oddball abundances, 10,000 times solar and phosphorus and underabundant helium and strange things. The other two stars have much poorer constraints. So this other star is a 260 kilometers per second rotator, so it's really hard to get much metallicity information on that. Yeah, I think that's about it. Yeah, anyway. There's not much constraint.
So Warren, if you could go back to your color diagram where you were selecting targets. So the thing I'm trying to understand is, this is some field in the halo, nominally.
This is the Sloan footprint, so it's the fifth of the sky covered by Sloan.
So I would presume that there would be subdwarf B stars out there in the halo, and that's a large population relative to this population. So.
Well, I mean,
have you found a lot of subdwarf B stars?
Well, 49 to 50 of our stars are normal halo stars, so I don't know what they are. The problem is, the horizontal branch crosses the main sequence at roughly the effective temperature at 12,000 Kelvin, say, that we're targeting. So they have identical surface gravities for their effective temperature. You can't make much discrimination.
Right, but they have a very different age. That's why I'm asking.
Sure. But,
so how do you convince yourself that the high-velocity stars you're seeing are not subdwarf B stars?
Well, I guess that's a possibility, but I guess if they have a long-lived progenitor, then there's no reason why we couldn't see them falling back onto the galaxy.
So right now you have no discriminant.
Subdwarf B stars are evolved low-mass stars that have lost a lot of hydrogen envelope, right?
Yes.
So that means that turn-off stars in the halo today could become a subdwarf B star, in which case, if such an object was ejected a Hubble time ago, there's no reason why we can't find it orbiting back and forth and falling back onto the galaxy today. And we don't observe that. We just don't see anything falling back onto the galaxy at minus 400 kilometers per second. So I think that tells you that that's the lifetime constraint.
But you have no spectroscopic understanding of whether they're a subdwarf B star or a normal B star.
No, I mean, what we measure is you know, that, I mean, this is what we have to work with. So there's no strong spectroscopic constraint we can place on the stars, other than that the spectral type is consistent with the photometry. I mean. They're mean sequence stars. One's a 260 km per second rotator, so it can't be an evolved star, right? Those are slow rotators. The peculiar B star is clearly a main sequence star. The LMC one's also a fast rotator, it's a main sequence star. So the ones with the shell spectroscopy all are main sequence stars.
So you have four solid.
Yes. And I'm arguing on this kinematic argument that the rest probably are. I mean, that's not to say that there's could be a couple in there that are not, but the bulk of the population, we don't see anything falling back onto the galaxy.
So what are the prospects for getting good proper motions for these, and is that the way to rule out or confirm Julio's hypothesis?
The question is proper motions. The expected proper motions, like I said, are of order a tenth of a milliarc second per year at these distances. These are radial stars on radial orbits, presumably, so that there shouldn't be much proper motion component to their velocity in any case. The Hubble Space Telescope should measure at sort of 3 to 5 sigma detections in a couple year baseline. So given that the service mission has been postponed, the better time baseline only helps our measurement. So I think that I was hoping we'd have an answer for the first 5 stars by the end of this year, but it looks like we'll have to wait. I think knowing the full space trajectory will tell us, for example, where that star from the LMC, you know, if it's coming from our galaxy or coming from the LMC.
I just wanted to add to that, you know, one of the things that the ELT would potentially do is if you could imagine having a system like Andrea, you know, has been getting this amazing stuff from the galactic center. If you can get deep enough and you can get a field of reference stars around these, then you could start to potentially imagine doing this from the ground. But right now, the space is the only way to get the astrometric precision.
Any more questions? Still a couple minutes. Okay, if not, let's just break for coffee and thank Warren again.